Be seated. Court is ready to hear oral argument from the lay court in all of these.
Next matters never up.
No, I've got them. I just don't want to read them all.
May it please the court, Mr. Bob Shannon and Mr. Byron Lee will present arguments for the lay court. Relators have reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Shannon will open for the first 12 minutes.
May it please the court, I represent Health Trust, Inc., but I'm here presenting argument for Relator Health Trust and Wharton Hospital Corporation. This is a mandamus suit involving an order imposing death penalty sanctions. The underlying lawsuit is a death action pending in the District Court of Matagorda County. In their suit, plaintiffs claim that Yolanda Salazar contracted and died of Legionnaires' disease. Health Trust and Wharton are two of some 30-odd defendants in the underlying suit. On April the 6th, 1994, Judge Neil Caldwell signed the order imposing death penalty sanctions on Health Trust and Wharton. In addition, Judge Caldwell ordered the special master to release all documents held for in-camera examination, including documents submitted by a non-party St. Paul Insurance Company. As the Mr. Chief Justice indicated, there are three pending petitions here, which consolidated for argument. Related to one petition is St. Paul, and the other two Health Trust and Wharton. And Mr. Lee will speak in behalf of St. Paul following my remarks. Now, there have been a lot of papers filed in the case. For example, the April 6th order, the death penalty sanction, totals some 73 pages and contains some 243 findings of fact. And the plaintiffs have filed briefs resembling Judge Caldwell's orders, except it's only longer. I think it may be useful to step back and examine the controlling questions for decision, and this morning I hope to be able to discuss with you two issues. The first being whether death penalty sanctions may be imposed for failure to produce documents that are not in the custody of the witness from whom they are requested. And second, whether lesser sanctions were tested before death penalty sanctions were imposed in this case. First, we submit that failure to produce documents not in the custody of the witness from whom they were subpoenaed or requested is not sanctionable. Most of the facts underlying this issue are not disputed. In March of 1993, the plaintiff subpoenaed documents from Douglas Streckert, including certain privileged patient records and certain physician hospital committee peer reports, in connection with his oral deposition. At the time of the subpoena, Streckert was the administrator of the Valley Regional Hospital, which is owned by a subsidiary of Health Trust. Neither Valley nor its owner is a party to the underlying litigation. Judge Caldwell, however, found that Streckert was an employee of Health Trust, and for purposes of these proceedings, we don't dispute that finding. Relators filed a motion for protective order, and everybody agrees that the relators failed to introduce evidence supporting the asserted privileges at the master's first hearing on the motion for protective order, which was conducted before Streckert's oral deposition. After the hearing, the special master recommended to Judge Caldwell that relators had waived their objections to production of the documents subpoenaed from Streckert because they had failed to support them with proof. Now, incidentally, with respect to the master's recommendation, we first noticed that certain of the privileges by statute may not be waived, and we feel that Judge Caldwell's failure to follow the statute was a clear abuse of discretion. Second, relators have always maintained that they had no obligation to furnish evidence in support of their claim of privilege where the request for the document was not appropriate under Rule 166b-4. And there's a recent case out of the Tyler Court in support of this position, Ford Motor Company against Ross, decided by the Tyler Court in October of 1994. The Tyler Court cites as authority a dissenting opinion by Justice Heck in the Lofton against Martin case, Now, we have filed that opinion with the clerk's office this morning, and it should be available to the court. But assuming for purposes of argument that there was a waiver, the dispute underlying this issue is a legal one regarding the breadth of the waiver privilege. The plaintiff's claim that relator's failure to introduce evidence when initially requested from Strecker obligated the relators themselves, not just Strecker, to produce the documents. In other words, the plaintiffs contend that the service of subpoena book is taken on any employer of a corporate party is the same as service on the corporation itself. We contend, however, on the other hand, that the failure to introduce evidence of the privileges could result in no more than in the waiver of the privileges as to the documents that were in Strecker's possession. In signing the March 29, 1993 order, Judge Caldwell accepted the master's recommendations and found waiver. In compliance with Judge Caldwell's order, Strecker was produced for oral depositions, and he, at the deposition, produced the documents in his possession. Later, Judge Caldwell accepted the plaintiff's expanded waiver argument and then imposed sanctions on relators for not producing documents that were not in Strecker's possession. We think the resolution of the problem involves an examination of Rule 201, which I believe we have put it before you, and we've taken the liberty of numbering the sentences in paragraphs 2 and 3. Paragraph 2 of Rule 201 provides that a witness may be compelled by subpoena to produce documents within his care, custody, or control. If they wanted to request documents from Horton or Health Trust, they were required under paragraph 4 of 201 to name those corporations as witnesses and request the corporation designate persons to testify. Because they only named Strecker as a witness, any privilege waiver we contend could not possibly be waived as to documents not in his possession. Now, they rely on paragraph 201 paragraph 3. They claim that the third sentence of Rule 201 paragraph 3 means that a party's employee or any person subject to the control of the party may be compelled by notice to produce all documents in the possession of the party, regardless of whether such documents are in the possession of the named opponent. We disagree. Let's examine for a minute rule paragraph 3 of Rule 201. In general, what Rule 201 paragraph 3 does is dispense with the necessity for a subpoena when you have a party involved. In other words, you can compel the party or a person that's subject to the control of the party to come in by notice. The first sentence of Rule 201.3, when the deponent is a party, service of the notice will have the same effect, as I say, as a subpoena. Under the second sentence, when the deponent is a party's employee, service of the notice will have the same effect as a subpoena served on the deponent. I think it's important to emphasize or notice that the second sentence does not say that notice will have the same effect as a subpoena served on the party. Rather, it says has the same effect as a service of a subpoena upon the deponent itself. Now, the third sentence simply provides that documents can also be requested from a party or its employees by notice rather than by formal subpoena. The third sentence specifically states, however, that the notice can compel production of things as in paragraph 2 hereof. And looking back to paragraph 2 hereof, we see that it limits a witness's production to those items in his care, custody, or control, limits a witness's production obligation to those items. Therefore, we believe that the plain language of Rule 201 defeats the argument advanced by the plaintiffs, adopted by Judge Caldwell, and made the basis of the sanctions order. Now, at the time, or about the time of the March 29th order, two major players in this scenario agreed that the subpoena sought no more than the documents in Strecker's possession. On April the 5th, just a week after the order was signed, the special master himself made it crystal clear that the order did not require such production by assuring Relator's counsel that Strecker was not going to have to produce documents that he did not have. The same view was expressed by plaintiff's counsel in a letter to relator's counsel immediately prior to the March 29th order, in which he acknowledged that, I quote, "The subpoena Duke has taken requests documents and things in Mr. Streckert's possession, custody, and control." Although the procedural history of this case has been long and it's been very unpleasant, we submit that the party's entire dispute rests fundamentally on this question of law. Now, the second issue we'd like to discuss involves the rule announced in Chrysler against Blackmun that lesser sanctions must be tested before death penalty sanctions may be imposed. Here, the sanctions order plainly violates that rule. Plaintiffs assert, and I quote, "Relators have refused to comply with the trial court's orders and produce material evidence despite two sanctions orders awarding monetary damages totaling more than $8,000. As a matter of fact, though, Horton itself was never sanctioned at all before Judge Caldwell entered the death penalty sanction against it, and plaintiffs don't even dispute that. However, in their most recent brief filed last week, they attempt to avoid this fact by asserting that Health Trust has Horton's sole shareholder control of the litigation. This argument resembles, we think, sort of a piercing of the veil argument, which we feel has no place in the sanctions analysis. We point out that Health Trust and Horton are separate corporations, they're separate defendants, and they're entitled to due process of law and are entitled to protection of the court's opinion under Chrysler. It's extremely misleading for the defendants, or that is the plaintiffs, to say that the Relator Health Trust refused to comply with a court order despite two sanctions orders. One of the sanctions order which they're referring to is the very April 6th order which granted the death penalty. Obviously, this order was not entered prior to the imposition of the death penalty. The other sanction order was signed on March 25th of 1994, and it required Health Trust to pay some $50,000 within 10 days. Health paid that within 10 days under protest. 2 days later, on April the 6th, Judge Caldwell imposed the death penalty against Health Trust and Board. Nothing happened, Your Honors, between the imposition of the monetary sanction and the imposition of the death penalty to demonstrate that relators had failed to improve their conduct despite the imposition of lesser sanctions. None of the relators' claimed misconduct occurred after the imposition of the monetary sanction. Therefore, we ask this court to resolve whether Judge Caldwell complied with the court's directive in Chrysler against Flatt. I yield the cross for St. Paul.
Counsel, while you're collecting your thoughts, is it correct that Judge Caldwell has resigned from the bench and will leave office January 1?
That is my understanding, Your Honor.
And there will be an appointment. Somebody will be appointed at some date after January 17th to replace Judge Caldwell.
That is also my understanding. May it please the Court. I first became involved in this case in September of 93 when Leah Baumann received a notice of deposition and a subpoena Duke was taken as a third-party witness in this case. At that time, I was told that if I ever allowed St. Paul's claim file to leave my office, it would end up in its entirety in the hands of the plaintiffs. I, rather naively today, ignored that advice. I brought that question up to Judge Caldwell in a September hearing, and Judge Caldwell promised me from the bench, and I quote, "I give you my word, I'll sign an order. I'm not going to divulge any material that has been submitted for in-camera inspection." And in fact, he did sign such an order on October the 4th of 93 that guaranteed my clients basic due process. Prior to the signing of that order, St. Paul had made proper objection to all of the requests for production of documents subpoenaed to mistake them. We had specifically and precisely set forth our privileges, our protections. We had provided uncontroverted affidavit evidence in support of those privileges and protections. We had provided a privilege log. There was no order ever entered overruling our objections or our claims of privilege. But I had made a terrible mistake. I had entrusted those documents, my entire client's file, for in-camera inspection. That trust was violated. Due process got a slap in the face when on April the 6th of 94, Judge Caldwell, with no notice, with no hearing, released my client's entire file to the plaintiffs. Within 24 hours, the plaintiffs had sent that file to over a dozen attorneys in the case in an effort to frustrate this mandamus proceeding. That file contained a number of privileged and protected documents, including consulting expert information and reports, the investigation by Ms. Domlin of the claim, the reserve information, the evaluation information, the strategy of how to defend the case. It contained my work product. It contained my advice to Ms. Domlin about her deposition. All of that, in its entirety, was released to the plaintiffs. And four-fifths of the documents in St. Paul's file were...
Mr. Lee, was counsel present when Judge Caldwell made those assurances to you, opposing counsel?
Yes. Opposing counsel was in the courtroom at that time. Well, you, and of course, got a copy of the order as well.
Well, you were given those assurances by Judge Caldwell?
Yes. Four-fifths of the documents in St. Paul's file, by the way, occurred after this March 29th order that you're going to hear a great deal about, I suspect. The documents weren't even in existence at the time an earlier order was entered that the plaintiffs somehow rely upon to justify their conduct. St. Paul, of course, by case law and by its own contract, has an independent duty to investigate the claims, and it did so. There was no sanction motion even filed against St. Paul, much less any order of sanctions against St. Paul until the April 6th order was handed down by Judge Caldwell. St. Paul, it is undisputed, committed no wrong in this case, only the mistake of trusting its documents for in-camera inspection. There is no remedy in law for this intolerable abuse. St. Paul very simply asked this court, make permanent the stay order that you've entered and strike all sanctions that Judge Caldwell has entered.
With regards to privileges, you know, not to tell it's been wrong. Don't you lose all your privileges now that they're out for the bar?
No, Your Honor. Just like, first of all, this court has entered a stay order to protect that. They've all been returned. The plaintiffs cannot be rewarded for taking in the dark of night my file and sending it out to other people. Just like when a jury hears something they shouldn't have heard, a trial court can instruct them to disregard the evidence. This court can instruct all parties to this case to disregard what they have seen in that file, and that is an adequate remedy, and we know the plaintiffs will comply with that court's order.
The court had an opportunity to write about inadvertent disclosure and make some...
Yeah, there's no inadvertent disclosure here, Your Honor. Everything to the contrary. We did everything I could think of to protect that file.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. John Tyler will present argument for respondents.
Thank you, Your Honor. My view of cases is tremendously different from what has been spoken so far, and I've frankly been surprised by the tone of what's been said. First of all, reply to a couple of the arguments that were made. With regard to the Rule 201 argument, the deposition notice was not sent to Mr. Strecker. The deposition notice, a copy of which you have in front of you, was sent to the relators themselves. Now, after they received that, the relators filed a motion for protection on their own motion, got it set for a hearing before the deposition, presented no evidence, and under Rule 166b4, and there's no dispute that they presented no 166b4 evidence, all of their privileges were waived. Unlike what has just been presented.
The only thing they could have done, or what they should have done under your theory of the case, is if the deposition notice named Mr. Steckert and not relators, they should have brought with them all of the documents, responsive, subpoena,
yes,
had them segregated and tendered to the court for in-camera inspection, even though the subpoena didn't name Relator?
No, the subpoena did name Relators. The deposition notice, the subpoena, went to the Relators. It did not go to Mr. Strecker.
But did it name Mr. Strecker, or did it name...
If you look at the, Chief Justice, if you look at 2, the colon, who it was addressed to...
Well, I understand, but the Rule 201 says when the deponent named is a public or private organization, the subpoena or no, shall notice or direct the deponent named to designate a person or persons. And you've done the designation.
A couple of paragraphs under that, it says that if a party, if the person whose deposition is being taken is under the control of the party, then the deposition notice serves the same function as a subpoena on the Relators. But importantly,
no, it says served on the deponent. Shall have the same effect as a subpoena served on the deponent. You're deposing Mr. Stecker, right?
Yes, sir, but we were clearly requesting all the documents from the Relators.
The statute says will have the same effect as a subpoena served on the deponent. So how could you be requesting documents from somebody else when you're deposing Mr. Strecker? The rule says the deponent.
I understand your position, mate. Can I respond?
Yes, sir.
Indirectly.
Okay.
The motion for protective order, which they filed, requested a motion for protective order to protect themselves, the Relators, not just Mr. Strecker, from producing any of these things.
Just asking you, if you send a deposition notice and you say we're going to depose Mr. X, and the rule says that sending that shall have the same effect as a subpoena served on Mr. X, how can it be addressed to Y, whatever Y may be?
But the subpoena was not addressed or limited to Mr. Strecker. The subpoena, Your Honor...
He's the deponent. The
That's
rule
correct.
Says deponent. So how can it be somebody else? That's my question.
Because Mr. Strecker was under the control of the party. And I think
what
we
part
just
of
read
the rule is that
under 201.
Yes. And where does it say you get to make this? It seems to me you can depose anybody in the corporation you want, or you can depose the corporation, but the two don't merge.
Okay. May I proceed to my next point?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, no, I'd like to know where you're pointing to in the rules.
Well,
this satisfies that this notice allows the corporation to be deemed to have waived by anything that it didn't produce.
Everything that the questions from you, sir, and from Justice Hecht, the way I've always read the rule, is that when it talks about having the same effect as a subpoena served on the deponent, is that the corporation needs to produce the documents at the deposition of that deponent.
Well, who do you say the deponent is here?
The deponent was Mr. Strecker. He was the witness. But the deposition notice went to the corporations. But my move to a step because there's another response. The motion for protective order that was filed sought protection not only from the documents in Mr. Strecker's personal care custody control, but also raise the issues which regard to all of the documents of the Relators. They then set that hearing on their own motion and then produced no evidence of that. At that point...
What kind of evidence would they produce?
Wouldn't
it be a legal argument that this is an inadequate subpoena under Rule 201?
No, sir. As the rules provide, you have either affidavits or live testimony or submit copies of the documents in camera.
So you contemplate a full-blown hearing with full document production when the legal question is whether this subpoena reaches Relator's documents?
Once they raised in their motion for protection these issues, including the entire scope of what we're talking about, the corporation's documents, then it was their burden, clearly under 166B, to come forward and to produce that kind of evidence. And that was the reason the master was appointed. They clearly did not do so. And this court has rules that...
Let me see about this. You send a notice, you say you want to take Justice Gonzalez's deposition. that you send the notice to me. I can't figure out why you sent the notice to me, but I don't want to do anything to, that's going to compromise my position, so I file a motion for protection in the court, and I say, I don't know what Judge Gonzalez has to produce, but I don't have to produce anything, and I don't know why I got sent this notice. And your position is, if I don't put evidence on of whatever claims of privilege I have at that time, I've waived. Even though my legal position is, I shouldn't even gotten this.
If you, they never even raised this argument, Justice Hag, at the hearing.
But your position is, I do need to put on that evidence.
Yes, sir. Okay. Because Rule 166 says that, and if I can refer the court to a longstanding series of your opinions, there are six in a row, start with Brayton versus Downey, or the Lowry case, Messina, Weisel, Lindsay versus O'Neill, and Britton v. Smith, where exactly this situation happened. And the court ruled that once the issues are raised in a 166B hearing, which is what happened here, once these issues are raised, then you've got the burden to come forward with your evidence. And that the failure to do so is a waiver.
Have we ever held that, that the respondent to a subpoena is under that burden when they are not requested, not the deponent?
Factually, I don't know if that has happened, but...
So this case is a little, is different, you will concede at least.
No, sir, no, sir. No, I learned how to go about it.
This is on all four of those cases.
No, sir, you're jumping to the other extreme. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying,
well,
though, is that...
I'm asking questions.
I beg your pardon.
I'm trying to ask questions to figure out what your position is.
Right. My position is consistent with the express language of 166B and the six Supreme Court authorities I've just referred to, that if a party comes forward and the relators themselves came forward and they read the subpoena to apply to them, because that's what it says in their motion for protection, once they raise those issues and it was raised, they set the hearing, then they have the burden to come forward. And the failure to do that is a waiver. This very argument regarding Rule 201, it was never raised until one of the mandamus, one of the 50 or more mandamus requests for relief in this case. And in fact, it's been raised twice to this Supreme Court, and you have overruled it twice on June 30th of 1994. No, 1993, I beg your pardon. But there's a lot more to this than just Mr. Strecker. There's an awful lot more to it, and much of it is unpleasant. I'm not going to rehash everything. But the order said clearly, I'd like to just demonstrate during my remaining time, that we did, or the court did comply exactly with every requirement of Transamerica. The court may recall that in Transamerica there was a failure of a deponent to appear and a failure to produce documents. That's what happened in this case. After the master's ruling, contrary to what the judge has said, Mr. Strecker skipped his deposition. His attorneys filed affidavits saying that they were surprised and didn't know he was going to skip the deposition. We finally got to take part of Mr. Strecker's deposition. He said, I was in Houston and I had documents. And I had come there for the deposition and I got a call from their attorneys telling me not to come. So he stayed in his hotel room that Monday and worked. Well, this was contrary to sworn statements made by relators' attorneys in the case. They also filed an affidavit saying that Mr. Strecker was not under their control. Well, Mr. Strecker says, sure, I was under their control. They say that Mr. Strecker's produced documents. He has not produced documents. He testified that not only did he bring documents for the first deposition that he didn't produce, but that he could have gotten a lot more responsive documents from the other hospitals if he'd asked for them. And none of these pages, none of these documents were produced either. Now, after Mr. Strecker skipped the deposition and did not attend his deposition or produce any documents, following what the Transamerican Court recommended, which was to number one, set a date for the deposition, number two, say the documents should be produced on that date, and number three, give them a warning of death penalty sanctions, which is exactly what the court did. Almost all the misconduct that we're complaining of occurred after that happened. Now, one reason, let me also, in addition to that...
All the misconduct occurred after March 25th?
29th, almost all of it, except for skipping the first deposition that was noticed.
And, let, they, and it Judge Caldwell assessed a $50,000 penalty for the missed deposition?
No, sir. Judge Caldwell did not. The master suggested at a later hearing, after we'd been through some mandamuses, the attorney's fees be granted. Okay? The way it was worked, that was referred to Judge Caldwell. Now, they're complaining that the lesser sanctions, the $50,000 order, came down, you know, just right before the death penalty order came from. The reason that that happened was more than 263 days of stays after the master suggested the lesser sanctions passed because of all the mandamuses that they had filed, including the same arguments over and over and over again. And the policies of the Court of Appeals in Corpus, from my point of view, and I believe the policy here, is that when serious issues are raised, then basically the stay is automatic until the stay is resolved. And what they have done, and it's all laid out in meticulous detail in the brief, what they have done is to immediately, right before another sanction, another delay ended, they filed another mandamus, and they kept doing that. Finally, when in June, when this Honorable Supreme Court overruled two of their mandamuses on the same date, on June 30th, they immediately filed the next day a motion to recuse Judge Caldwell. That had the effect of, again, putting in an automatic stay. And let me also say, and this is something that's unpleasant, but I must mention it, the motion to recuse Judge Caldwell was verified by Relator's Counsel. Every statement in there stated as a basis was false. The entire affidavit was false. Not only Gail Friend was the attorney that signed the affidavit, they offered no evidence in support of any of their claims, and Mr. Minton, during the oral argument on the record, actually said, yes, we don't have any evidence to prove any of this up, and furthermore said their whole basis of their recusal was that Judge Caldwell had been prejudiced toward plaintiffs. Mr. Minton actually said in the record that he did not take that position. Now, they also made a similar attempt to get rid of the discovery master. Gail Friend again signed affidavits regarding factual statements in that. Every one of those factual statements was incorrect, too. It had been proven to be incorrect, and as a matter of fact, the judge had them retain criminal counsel because some of the documents that they had filed in support of the motion to recuse the master were so clearly false, and these are all laid out again in the supplementary findings of fact and conclusions of law.
Are discovery sanctions available for filing motions to recuse or for seeking mandamus relief from the appellate court?
For false verifications under oath, regardless of what the discovery I was saying at the time is. And the case law from this court also focuses repeatedly that if the client, that the client can be sanctioned for the relator's conduct, I'm sorry, for the attorney's conduct. But in addition to this, there was misconduct involved.
Well, we said the sanction ought to address whoever it is who committed the offense, whether it be the client or the attorney. But here you say a lawyer signed a false affidavit, and yet it was the client who was sanctioned.
Yes, because they were also involved in that. Let me also, we tried to take the depositions of 16 of their employees, and this is all on the record. Not a single one of those 16, not one, complied with subpoena duties taken. Almost all of them came with no documents whatsoever. We tried to take the depositions of four records custodians of Health Trust. They all skipped their depositions, didn't produce any documents. We were able to take the depositions of two of the records custodians for Wharton Hospital Corporation, and they refused to answer any questions whatsoever with regard to the documents of which they were custodians. Now, they have filed four affidavits, including not just counsel, but employees of the relators, in which they have sworn in their mandamus proceedings that there are 34 separate categories of documents. I'm sorry, that there are more than 1 million pages of privileged documents which are responsive to the trial court's order. They have now filed in this proceeding here today another verification stating just the opposite. Now, in addition to that, we have testimony, and this is all on the record, of no fewer than 34 kinds of categories of documents, all of which are responsive to the subpoena, none of which have been produced. So this is not a situation where
it, you know, it's just one quick decision by the court.
Would you address the statement by Mr. Lee that Judge Caldwell had given assurances from the bench and signed an order of non-disclosure of the in-camera materials that were submitted and then subsequently?
Yes, sir. He may have done that. If Mr. Lee is saying that he did, then I will agree to that. I can see.
Were you there, counsel?
I do not recall being there at the time, but Judge, but there we've had nine. We've had nine evidentiary hearings before the master. We've had five evidentiary hearings in front of the trial court.
Do you all remember something as significant as the court saying these documents will not be disclosed, they will be protected, any in-camera documents from St. Paul will not be turned over? You don't recall?
The judge, we had so many mandamuses, Judge, that every time, you know, in his orders, the judge would say, for instance, that we'll hold the order back until you go up with mandamus review. I don't know what went through the judge's mind when he ordered those documents released, but let me address those documents that were released, if I may. First of all, I do not recall anything being in there about expert theories of the case.
This is the claims file for St. Paul?
Yes, sir. Okay, and I don't have those documents. But I do know two things that were in
just
there.
Just make sure, St. Paul, who does St. Paul insure?
Yes, sir. St. Paul, and let me address that. St. Paul, under the Ranger Gwynn case of this court,
who
is the
St. Paul insure?
Both relators. Okay? So as a matter of law, they are the agent of those relators. The relators, under the GTE case, is one of the post-Transamerican cases. If the relators had the legal right to get those documents, then they are properly produced.
So you take the position that in an ongoing liability case that you can concurrently discover the contents of the claims file of the defendant's insurer?
Yes, sir, once the privileges are waived, because these privileges...
Now, when did those privileges get waived?
They were waived at the initial hearing, and 4 days later when the trial court heard a hearing on the same instance, they again produced no evidence whatsoever. But these are not St. Paul's...
I thought the initial hearing had to do with Mr. Strecker, but you're saying it also encompassed these documents?
Yeah, I've not been clear with the court. The motion for protective order was not limited to Mr. Strecker. It was brought by relators on behalf of relators with regard to relators' documents.
Including okay. St. Paul.
St. Paul was not named then, but...
So how can the privilege as to their documents be waived at a time when they're not a party to the lawsuit by something that HealthTrust did?
Because it was not St. Paul's documents that were privileged by any of St. Paul's privileges.
The claims file?
Yes, sir. What I'm telling you is the claims file primarily consisted, to my recollection, of documents which had been written by employees of the relators, which, by the way, the relators had, those witnesses had denied had ever occurred. My red light is on.
You may answer questions as long as we have. Are you satisfied with that answer? Are there any other questions? Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you.
Comments on rebuttal. They complained about the length of time or delay taken by this court or the Corpus Christi court in entering an order staying. And Judge Caldwell, I think, had 16 findings in his order saying that he was basing the sanctions order in part on the delay that these relators had caused. Because of the state orders in the appellate courts, we take the position that delay, of course, is a function of an order issued by an appellate court. It's a matter for the appellate court to decide. Rule 84 allows the appellate court to impose sanctions for an appeal taken for delay. And I expect that it would apply also for a mandamus taken for delay. None of those sanctions were imposed. he would also refer, and I think also it's important here that, that those very orders that were taken to the Corpus Court and this court had to do with actions by the trial court, and it's improper for the trial court to be passing on whether or not those were proper matters that were trying to set aside his order to be a basis for sanctions. I think a reading of the sanctions order in the case shows the approach taken by the plaintiffs and by Judge Cobble. Any position taken by the relators or their counsel in this case that's contrary to that taken by the relators or by Judge Cobble or the plaintiffs is immediately labeled as a misrepresentation. Neither the sanctions nor plaintiff's briefs makes any allowance for any legitimate differences of opinion, factual disagreements, disagreements on the law. And then the sanction order itself makes no attempt to quantify or define any harm to plaintiffs resulting from the claimed representations. It makes no explanation why the relator should be sanctioned out of court. Finally, in closing, I'd like to turn to the issue of what can be done to remedy the harm that's been caused by the released plaintiff's counsel in the subsequent publication of relator's most confidential attorney-client communications. In that connection, Judge Cornyn, these relators' records of their expert witnesses, their trial strategy.
Counsel, your time has expired. Does somebody have a question?
Would you please? I think you're always involved in the records that were published to all of the lawyers in the case and were sent to all of the courts.
And so, do you agree with your opponent that St. Paul was not a party to the lawsuit at the time that the initial hearing regarding the motion protective order regarding Mr. Strecker's deposition?
No, St. Paul was not a party.
But as I understand, the argument is because the insurance company is the agent of its insured that failure to bring the documents and to produce them and to plead and prove the privilege at that time waived not only Health Trust's privilege but also St. Paul's privilege to the claims file?
I understand that's
is
the
that
argument.
Your but, understanding of the argument?
But it's my understanding, but I certainly don't agree that that's the law.
You were about to say, and so...
we've asked for dismissal of these parties from the lawsuit, and we realize that dismissal from the lawsuit is a drastic step, but we feel that that's the only cure that can be made for the prejudice caused to these parties.
Now, who are you intending, who do you want us to dismiss?
Relators, Health Trust, and Wharton has been the only way the prejudice can be erased.
So any potential liability that may be out there for Legionnaires' disease, you know, you're absolved because you're no longer a party.
Well, we don't have the ability, Judge, now to present our defenses whether or not we have any liability at all because they know our case. And in closing, then I would say, in that connection, they still got between 20 and 30 defendants in the case. I would ask the court to fashion a remedy to try to cure the prejudice done these parties and to set aside the death penalty sanctions. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you. The court will take another brief recess.
Scotty, this is Rod.